Hello, and welcome to the RCGP podcast on pollen food syndrome. My name is Tony Hazel, and I'm a GP and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. Today, I will be talking to Dr. Isabel Skipala, consultant dietitian and clinical lead for food allergy based at the Royal Brompton Hospital. Isabel is also an honorary senior clinical lecturer at Imperial College. Thank you for joining us today, Isabel.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So today we're going to be discussing pollen food syndrome, or PFS, which some will also know as oral allergy syndrome. To start with, perhaps you could tell me briefly what PFS is and why it has such a seemingly strange name. What has pollen got to do with food allergy?
So, well, first of all, pollen food syndrome is where the allergens in fruits and nuts, specific allergens, but also sometimes in vegetables, can cause quick and short-lived allergic reactions. But these reactions don't happen if the foods are cooked because these allergens are denatured. Now, a key difference between pollen food syndrome and primary food allergy is speed of onset. It's often a few seconds to minutes for pollen food syndrome compared to 15 to 30 minutes for a primary food allergy, or even longer. Pollen food syndrome can also present at any point in life, often later than primary food allergy in children, and is linked to hay fever. And that's where the name comes from, the fact that most people with pollen food syndrome will also be allergic to pollen, most commonly silver birch, but it can be others. And it is the cross-reactivity between antibodies in the pollen and proteins in the plant foods which causes the reaction.
Thank you. That's a really useful explanation. So we're going to try and tease out which patients need investigation and who can be managed in primary care with just the history. Now, I have a particular interest in this because I think I have pollen food syndrome. If I eat plums or cherries, my mouth itches. And if I eat certain vegetables such as mange tout raw, then I get a quite dramatically hoarse voice, which resolves fairly quickly within half an hour. I've never seen my GP about it, and I just avoid those foods. If I presented to primary care with that problem in the absence of any other food allergies, how should it be managed?
Well, what you're describing is a clear history of typical pollen food syndrome, in that the symptoms are mild, nothing to suggest anaphylaxis, and they occur very quickly and are confined to the mouth and resolve just as quickly. Also, there are no reactions to nuts, which can complicate things. So this presentation can be dealt with just on the basis of the history, which is very clear. I would inquire about other atopic conditions such as asthma and hay fever to make sure they were being properly managed if present. And then I would diagnose pollen food syndrome on the basis of the history and tell you to avoid those foods when they're raw. They should be fine cooked as this denatures the allergens. However, light cooking, such as in a stir fry, may or may not cause symptoms. Now, if you accidentally ingest these foods and get very mild symptoms, then the simplest thing to do is to drink plenty of water. This washes the allergens down into the stomach where they are denatured. Sometimes that's all that's needed, but for persistent or more severe symptoms, you can take an antihistamine. They generally take around 15 to 20 minutes to work.
Thank you. That's reassuring to know that I'm not missing anything important. So let's make it a bit more complicated now and add nuts into the mix. Say you've got a mother who brings her 10-year-old to see you and the history sounds very much like pollen food syndrome, but one of the allergens is a nut. So do we need to start treating this like a primary nut allergy? Does mum need to start obsessively reading labels and avoiding things that say may contain traces of nuts, which seems to be pretty much every food label? Or can we treat pollen food syndrome reaction to nuts differently from a primary nut allergy?
Okay, well, first of all, it's important to say that children can get pollen food syndrome. And pollen food syndrome to nuts isn't the same thing as a primary nut allergy. So it's clearly important to work out whether this is pollen food syndrome or a primary nut allergy. The key things in the history are, as already discussed, particularly symptoms to raw nuts, but not to roasted ones, or to nuts in foods. Also, the speed of onset. An allergy that comes on while the nut is still in the mouth is much more likely to be pollen food syndrome than a primary nut allergy. Symptoms such as hives, itching and swelling of the face, hands and feet, vomiting and diarrhea are not normally symptoms related to pollen food syndrome. Sometimes patients can have swelling in the throat and feel breathless or wheezy, especially if they have asthma. We have to remember that being labelled as nut allergic has significant implications for a child or indeed an adult, so it's an important thing to differentiate between the two. During my research, I've developed a questionnaire that can be useful for history taking. It was designed for secondary care, but could also be used for primary care if helpful. Now, allergy tests might help. For example, a negative specific IgE or skin prick test to pollens reduces the likelihood of pollen food syndrome. The most likely pollen culprits will depend on location. So, for example, birch pollen is a common sensitization in the UK, whereas mugwort is much more common in, for example, Poland. And in Spain, it's grass pollens that are the main sensitizing allergens. Now, birch has allergens which are very similar to proteins in tree nuts, such as walnuts, hazelnuts, and almonds. So a patient who typically gets hay fever around the time the silver birch pollen is high, usually from late March, and also has a rapid onset allergy to, say, raw almonds, but can eat them in cakes, may well have pollen food syndrome rather than a primary allergy.
That's really useful. I'm going to add that to my history taking about being able to eat the food cooked but not raw. So thinking again about myself as a GP with this patient and their parent in front of me, would you suggest that I do a specific IgE test on a patient who is presenting with what appears to be pollen food syndrome to nuts?
Well, unfortunately, it's difficult to give a blanket yes or no answer to this, but it might be useful. You need to consider certain factors, such as what IgE tests are available to you locally. How sure are you of the diagnosis of pollen food syndrome? And also importantly, what access you have to a secondary care allergy clinic, either to see the patient or for advice. Now, if you do the tests, it's really important to know how to interpret them. A positive specific IgE to hazelnuts in the context of symptoms of pollen food syndrome indicates pollen food syndrome to hazelnuts and not a primary allergy. So clearly it makes sense for the patient to avoid eating that particular nut, but they don't have to carefully check every label and avoid all foods that say may contain traces of nuts or made in a factory where nuts are handled, as any nuts in foods labelled that way are likely to be cooked. And the consequences of accidental ingestion of raw nuts is much less significant than for a person with a primary nut allergy. Also, it's important to know that cashew and pistachio nuts do not normally provoke pollen food syndrome. So if they're one of the reported triggers, then it's much more likely to be a true nut allergy rather than pollen food syndrome.
Yes, that makes absolute sense. I suppose, as always, much depends on the history. So let's say that I have this patient with apparent pollen food syndrome to nuts and I decide to refer them. Do they need an adrenaline auto-injector, an AAI, while they're waiting to see the consultant?
Well, this is an interesting discussion, and I know it does cause problems in primary care, especially when an adrenaline auto-injector has been started but isn't really needed. Patients, and especially the parents of children with a pollen food syndrome, can be understandably concerned about any advice to stop carrying one. Clearly, if someone has had anaphylaxis in the past, they need to carry an adrenaline auto-injector. It is possible, though uncommon, to get anaphylaxis with pollen food syndrome. NICE guidelines advise that those who get angioedema, which usually manifests as swelling of the face, should carry one if they have other factors such as which might increase the risk of anaphylaxis, such as coexisting asthma, COPD or heart disease. Also, if the angioedema comes on with just a trace amount of the allergen, or indeed people who cannot easily avoid the allergen should probably also carry an adrenaline auto-injector. Now, people with asthma, particularly seasonal asthma, may have more severe reactions when they have pollen food syndrome. And so they may be people who possibly should be considered for an adrenaline auto-injector. I suppose really, again, it's an individual clinical judgment. You might consider an advice and guidance referral to your local allergy clinic about this particular issue while the patient is waiting to be seen. If you're not sure and decide to issue an adrenaline auto-injector when they're waiting, then maybe make it clear in the letter that you'd like advice about whether the patient needs it in the long term, and make the patient aware that you are seeking this advice rather than suggesting they need it lifelong.
Yes, I think that's really important. It's all about how it's said when you start something like an auto-injector. So what other advice might I give to a patient who's waiting to see someone in an allergy clinic?
Well, clearly, they should be advised to avoid the raw food triggers as much as possible, and that's sensible. Cooking the food may mean it's tolerated, providing it's well-cooked. It's important to perhaps also consider that soy milk can cause significant reactions. So I often suggest that someone who wants to avoid cow's milk doesn't change to soy milk or indeed a nut milk, but perhaps tries oat or rice milk instead. Also remember that smoothies and fresh fruit and vegetable juices are concentrated forms of allergens. They often contain multiple different raw fruits and vegetables and are best avoided. We've already talked about drinking water, but really it's important to know that antihistamines can be helpful. And if they are helpful, then they should be carried, the patient should carry them with them. If you're concerned that a patient's significantly restricting their diet, then it's probably really useful if you have local dietetic support to send the patient to them. They can go through the diet and see what foods may be tolerated best.
Thank you very much. I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much, Isabel, for giving us your thoughts and advice on pollen food syndrome. I found it really useful and I hope others have too. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening to this RCGP podcast on pollen food syndrome.